In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Since you're listening to this podcast, we have a very special offer for you. You can try 6 issues of BBC History Revealed magazine for just £9.99. That's a saving of 70% on the shop price. BBC History Revealed is the all-action history magazine suitable for the whole family. To find out more and take advantage of this offer, visit buysubscriptions.com/podcast. And if you're based in the US, you won't miss out. You can try 3 issues for just £9.95, saving a huge 70%. For more details, visit buysubscriptions.com/podcast. Both these offers end on the 15th of May, 2021. Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. The Peasants' Revolt of 1381 was a pivotal moment in the troubled reign of Richard II. New research from the People of 1381 Project is revealing that rather than being an ill-disciplined explosion of rage, it was actually organised with military precision. The cover feature of the May issue of BBC History Magazine explored this further, and our content director, David Musgrove, caught up with two of the project's researchers, Professor Adrian Bell and Dr. Helen Lacey, to find out more.
Today, I'm joined by Professor Adrian Bell and Dr. Helen Lacey, who are part of the research team of the People of 1381 Project. 1381 was, of course, the year of the Peasants' Revolt, and that's the cover feature of the May issue of BBC History Magazine, which was, in fact, written by the project team. So we're going to delve into the subject a bit more now. Adrian, Helen, welcome. Thank you for joining us. How are you both?
Yeah, doing well, thank you.
Good stuff. So, first question, we need to get into this topic to understand it. So, Helen, would you be able to summarise very briefly what happened in the Peasants' Revolt?
Yeah, sure. So this is the spring of 1381. The young Richard II, the king, is on the throne, and the English are fighting a war with the French, which had been going well, but has in recent years been going less and less well. And what happens is the government try to implement a poll tax. This was the third poll tax that they tried to impose in 4 years. And commissions are sent out to enforce payment. And this provokes sporadic outbreaks of resistance and discontent. So we see violence against the commissioners who are sent to collect the poll taxes. This is in Kent and Essex in particular, but spreads out into the rest of the home counties and East Anglia. And then by early June, the rebels, particularly the rebels in Kent and Essex, are coordinating their insurgency and planning to move on London. And then what happens is on the 12th of June, the rebels from Kent and Essex meet together and camp on Blackheath in southeast London. And there they're joined by an insurgent preacher, a man called John Bull, who is a radical priest. And then over the 13th to the 15th of June, there are a series of meetings where the rebels try to discuss their demands with the king, and the king comes out to talk to them, but they're variously aborted at different times. And famously, the rebels move to the Tower of London and they seek out and behead some of the key government officials.
OK, so you've mentioned John Bull there and Richard II. Who else are the main players in this story?
Yeah, so on the rebel side, we've got a man called Wat Tyler. We don't actually know much about him other than that he's a craftsman and he's a leader of the Kentish rebels. but he becomes sort of synonymous with the revolt. We've got John Ball, as you said, who is a radical preacher. He preaches this message of sort of radical Christian egalitarianism. So he famously says, when Adam delved and Eve span, who was then the gentleman? And then, as I've said, on the crown side, you've got the 14-year-old Richard II, who succeeded to the throne after his grandfather, Edward III, who was a famous king who'd won victories against the French. So he's got a lot to live up to. And his Richard II's uncle, John of Gaunt, who many suspect to be the real power behind the throne. And there's a real sort of feeling of unpopularity around John of Gaunt.
OK, now, what's the traditional interpretation of who was involved and why this happened?
Well, I think one of the main interpretations has been that in the decades after the Black Death, so the Black Death arrives in England in 1348, and in a two-year period decimates the population by almost a half. And the interpretation is that in the wake of this Black Death and population change, there's real social upheaval. And so people who were previously pinned at the bottom of the social ladder, if you like, as serfs working for lords in this feudal pyramid, that they are increasingly discontent with their lot. They can see the kind of ability to purchase land and perhaps gain surplus wage and so on after the Black Death, but they are being frustrated by government who are passing laws to keep them in their place at the bottom rung of the social ladder. Added to that, we've got political instability, Edward III's death. He becomes senile and dies, so his great glory years of victory against the French are well and truly over. His son, who was meant to inherit the Black Prince, who is a popular military martial figure, dies before his father. So then we have got this instability because the young Richard II now is taking the throne, which is something people hadn't expected. And that's always a cause of instability when you have a young king acceding to the throne. Added to that, we've got a downturn, as I've said, in the French wars, where the French have actually managed to marshal their troops and take the war back to the English. And they are now also launching raids even on the south coast of England. So there's real feeling of worry and concern that the French will actually invade England. And then, as I mentioned, finally, the poll tax seems to be the final straw in all of this, where the government are trying to impose this head tax on the population. So rather than a community-based income tax, they're now trying to levy a flat tax per head of the population, which is very, very unpopular.
So your research, the research of the team, is kind of nuancing that interpretation a bit, and we'll come to that through the discussion. And also, we'll talk a little bit more about the French Wars for anyone who's worried they're not on top of that. So don't worry, we'll come back to it in a little while. So are we correct to call it a peasants' revolt? That's the traditional term. That's what people associate with 1381, the famous term, the peasants' revolt. The peasants are revolting. Was it just peasants? Was it a revolt?
Well, it's actually christened the peasants' revolt only in the Victorian period. So John Richard Green christened it the peasants' revolt in 1874. But before then, so contemporaries at the period referred to it as variously as the Great Rumour, or that they were rising in a warlike fashion, or they even called it the Great Hurling Time. So they had no particular label for it, but it was associated with this idea of rumour and murmur and noise, which is quite interesting for us when we think about what sort of fears were conjured by the revolt in the minds of contemporaries.
Now, your research and what you've written about in the magazine feature has showed us that actually people involved in this revolt were there was a lot of former soldiers from England's wars in France. So we'll talk about that a bit more. But can one of you give us a sense about how you've been able to discover that fact?
Yeah, so perhaps I could talk about that more here now. The original idea of the project for me was, it's such a well-organized revolt that they're organized so well. They say they're going to do something, the rebels, and then they do it. They get into the Tower of London. They execute leading figures in government. And so ever since I was thinking about this, probably as an undergraduate, I thought that this is a bit that's not been explored. Why are they and how are they so successful? People who've investigated the Peasants' Revolt are more worried about, you know, and thought more about it being some sort of proto-Marxism type event. You know, they're more worried about the big picture. What does it tell us about society? Whereas I'm always very interested in things contrary to these ideas. So I wondered, well, how did they do it? And so myself and my colleague, who's also working on the project, Professor Anne Curry, in a previous project, have brought together the names of soldiers who fought for the English in the Hundred Years' War. So this is the war that went on, you know, another one of the things like Helen mentioned, a Victorian invention. It's a Hundred Years' War. It's longer than 100 years. It's wars between England and France and a number of kings on both sides around England's or the English king's claim to be King of France. So that's at base what's going on. And famously, Henry V, later than our period, so in 1415, Agincourt wins a famous battle and later is actually allowed to be King of France once the current King of France dies. So in a sense, it could be a very successful set of wars for the English, if you look at it that way. But this period, as Helen said, it's not going so well. But we've gathered the names of about 250,000 soldiers. And that's not 250 individuals, but 250,000 service records of men, mostly men, mainly men, who served the English crown during this period between about 1360 and 1453. And we can look at a subsection of those names and compare them against the names of the rebels, but also the rebels' victims and also other people who are mentioned at this time. And we're working with a group of computer scientists at the University of Southampton, Geodata, and we're able to then compare quickly lists of soldiers from our previous database with the peasants. I'm sorry, I always say the peasants, with the rebels, and find out, are these the same people?
So this is a big data project, essentially, then.
Yeah, so it always makes that I work in a business school, so it makes my colleagues laugh because they work with millions, or let's say millions of data points for big data. And I say, oh, this is medieval big data, when it's hundreds of thousands. And actually, in terms of rebels, we're talking, you know, up to about 10,000 names that we'll find named rebels of this time. But comparing one big data source with another is very exciting for us as medievalists to be able to do this. And we've got another big data source, which is the poll tax returns themselves, which are, again, hundreds of thousands. And they give us the names of the individuals with a location and also, in many cases, a payment. So we can say something about the socioeconomic status of these people. So they could be a soldier, they could be a rebel, and we might be able to say they came from this manor in this county, they did this role, this occupation, and paid this much tax.
So you've actually got quite a wealth of data then for this project in comparison to maybe some other medieval research projects.
Yes, I think so. All these a lot of medieval projects now are building up this sort of data. So there's another one now which we're also trying to intersect with called England's Immigrants, which goes through a long period of immigrants into England. So this is now happening. And the more people like us put their stuff online and make it openly available, so all our projects are always openly available for the public and for other researchers, the more we can start to compare and link. And when I did my PhD, you know, it probably was a long time ago. You know, I was painstakingly going through card indexes of names before it was computerized. And it was impossible. You know, you just couldn't do this work because it was impossible to compare one thing with another. Whereas now, even the work we're doing now, myself and Anne, just the other day, the computer sciences invented a new piece of, let's say, kit for us to basically compare two things. And we were just shocked with the speed of the results we're getting back and the number of hits we're getting, because we don't just look for exact matches, because at the time, the clerks wrote down your name. They said, what's your surname? And I might have said Bell, because that's my surname. They might have written Ball or Bell with an E or et cetera, or Bell with two E's, you know, so et cetera. So how do we know it's the same name? Well, we can do sound-alike comparisons using this computer science. So it's not just B-E-L-L that's compared. It'll bring in all these other elements of Bell to be able to do much wider search than's ever been possible.
And as you said, all this information is on your website, 1381.online. That's
right.
That's,
yes,
that's
And we'll be launching the public interface will be launched later this year. So we're just building up a pilot at the moment. It's working really well. And we're hoping to have that ready for before the end of the year. Hopefully, I say sooner, but it'll still be before the end of the year.
So we've got to, you've got all this information about the people involved in the period, and you are getting a sense that the Peasants' Revolt, and I'm going to keep calling it that, was much more coordinated than you might imagine, and that begs the question: who was doing the coordination?
So we find key soldiers. And we've been able to categorise these into different sorts of areas. So we've got this group of soldiers that are very mobile. So they land in, one example is John Pepper, and we write about him on our website. You can find a story about him. And he's in France campaigning with the Earl of Buckingham, another of Richard's uncles. Comes back in around the beginning of May, lands in England, and then a few days later, he's raising insurrection in Cambridge. So hugely mobile. They'll be mounted on horseback, riding around the countryside, creating a rebellion, a revolt as they go in groups of men. And these men are what we call esquires. They're men at arms. So they're armed on horseback, very much looking like the knights that you'd see in the films today, heavily armed, quite menacing, I expect. And then they'll be using their equipment to ride around raising insurrection. And they're riding across the country, as I said, John Pepper moving there. So this one set, you can see what are they working as, messengers or instigators. Then we've got other groups who have got expertise in military sort of technology. And they're using their skills to supplement the damage the rebels can do. And when you read about the damage they do, they're hugely successful in terms of they'll raise manor houses. And you've only got to look at any village and look at the manor, see how big they are. And they raise these to the ground, sometimes using a thing we call a trebuchet, so a very complicated catapult. There's others that are trained as masons, and they'd use that sort of ability to bring these houses down. So highly skilled military technology bringing back and using. And also, they're also very skilled in when you're on campaign with the English armies, they're all mounted, but they all manage to work in conjunction with each other. So your man at arms, your archers, they're working in conjunction. They know when to meet, when to do things, and it's these sorts of elements that I've always thought are part of the way this revolt carries on.
So John Pepper, this character you just talked about. If he's turning up back in England from the French Wars with a horse and a full set of arms and armament, he ain't no peasant, is he?
No, he's not a peasant. No, he's these people who are men at arms or esquires, would be fairly wealthy. They might be landowners, or they might have an occupation, and also just fighting as an English soldier is well paid. So an archer in the English armies gets 6 pence a day. And that's more than you get for being a labourer in agricultural work. And a squire, a man at arms, gets 12 pence a day. And as you went up the ranks, then your daily salary went up to an earl who would get a one mark a day. So it was all daily, all paid, all contracted. So that's how we have their names of these soldiers. It's a hugely bureaucratic administrative system set up by the English Crown to take account of how much money they're spending, making sure it's going on paying soldiers their daily rates, and it's all recorded by muster rolls with ticks and balances to make sure this all happens.
And I guess that's where part of your data set's from then, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's correct. Yeah.
So were there a lot of soldiers returning specifically in the early 1380s from France?
So there's just this one campaign comes back. It's not been that successful.
Yeah.
And there's a number of people also we found in the records who are deserters. So haven't actually joined, have said they're going to join this campaign and have not. And perhaps have been just looking around for things to do. But these soldiers, you could either say they're at a loose end, they're used to campaigning regularly. And this the amount of opportunities for their fighting abroad are less than they were. So the one argument we have is why there's so many soldiers is perhaps they're a bit frustrated by the lack of activity that they're able to get.
Sure. So they've come back onto English soil, and they've kept all their weapons and armaments. Is that that's not sort of royal property? It's their property.
Yeah, that's right. You're meant to come fully armed and arrayed. So when you muster, when you take the muster, they're checking that these people, if they're an archer, they've got a longbow. You provide them with arrows because the sort you're going to get through a lot of arrows on campaign. So there'd be carts full of arrows brought by that would be produced in England and taken across to France. But the actual basic equipment you'd be provided if you're in a you'd be expected to provide. Sorry, but if you're in a retinue. So we organise these things. Again, I'm getting a bit technical, but it's called indentured retinue. Indentured, the contract. The retinue's the group. And these retinue would be a mixed group led by a captain. And that would be a mixed group of knights, esquires and archers who would all be mounted. And in that group, the captain has some responsibilities for his group he's bringing with him, but he'll be expecting them to bring the equipment with them. But he has, you know, the sense they are a group and they operate together on these campaigns abroad, which operate, as we call it, another technical term, but as a chevauchee. So the chevauchee is a mounted raid, quite destructive. You know, none of this is very nice to talk. You know, we talk about it, but it's not nice. You know, in a sense, they go across France, destroying everything they could. The crops they would burn. They would try and take towns if they were easy to take. They wouldn't want to waste a lot of time on sieges. So if the town shut up against them, they'd leave it alone. But if they could quickly take town and village, they would. They'd burn them to the ground. They'd take all of the movable consumptible items with them. So they weren't a very nice thing to do. And France was open to that, and the English were willing and regularly did this.
So we've got a situation here that you're describing where we've got a bunch of armed, trained military men returning to English soil, disaffected potentially with the progress of the campaign they've been involved in, and possibly slightly bored that they've got no more fighting to do. Is the Crown making any sort of accommodation for them on their return to find further employment for them or pay them in any way?
No, these are, I guess you'd call them like semi-professionals. So it's not a professional army in any way. These people have other occupations and are part of society in their ordinary lives. And then every now and again, we find them going on campaign. Now, they may go on one campaign or they may go on multiple campaigns. So they're not like they have to be doing this. Normally, they may be a merchant. They may be a labourer. They could be anything, but also they may live in the town, they may live in the country. So it's all different groups of people coming together to fight these little campaigns. But when they come back, no, you've got your wages, you're paid. There's lots of stories about them bringing back lots of, let's say, stolen goods, which would then enhance their wages, and also ransoms. So they may take ransom prisoners. And they bring some of them back with them as well in hoping to make money from them. But there's nothing from the Crown following their experiences abroad in terms of to try and bring them back into society now.
And if listeners are interested in ransoms, there's a podcast in our archive. I chatted to a chap called Remy Amboul about ransoms in the Hundred Years' War. So look out for that one. So these soldiers, they're expected basically just to return to their civilian lives.
That's right. So they go back to life as it was before, and then they might wait for the next campaign. They may not, you know. So since that may be their only time they go abroad, but they may go numerous times. And we find that throughout our work with soldiers, that we can find a sort of a set. We like to say there's a professionalisation because it's a highly militarised society. It's not just the soldiers that will be used to fighting and being military. Remember, everyone's meant to practice archery. Every week at the Butts. So in a sense, it's something that will be expected of every individual.
Now, this is a question that I'm sure is very difficult for you to answer, and I doubt very much whether your data sources allow you to know about this. But I'm going to use a wildly anachronistic term of PTSD. Soldiers coming back from campaigns today often have mental health problems as a result of seeing horrific things. Is there anything that you can identify in the experience or the records that you've looked at to suggest that any of these people had similar sort of issues?
I mean, I think what I got to say is that sometimes a bad answer is that's a very interesting question, because it's one of those things where you say, I can't answer that. But I would think it's a great project is to look, what we can look at in the medieval period is what we call pardons. So people be pardoned for violent conduct, and this can be murder or even rape or a robbery. And what we find is lots of people being pardoned, and they get, as part of that pardon, they have to serve militarily. So as part of this pardon for being violent, you serve militarily. And what I wonder, if you look to see, do violent individuals become soldiers because of the pardoning, or does being a soldier make people violent? And that would actually answer one of the big questions that you've just asked me, in a sense, as we could then say, actually, we can see that it's the warfare itself that makes people violent, not violent until they come back from war. Or we may actually find, actually, it attracts, the military service is attracting violent individuals.
Mm. Okay, well, that sounds like a research project for somebody to take on.
And I've just given it away.
Well, there's quite a few people listening here, so if anyone wants to take it on, then contact you, I guess. So we've got a situation where there's all these soldiers in England potentially looking for something to do, potentially a threat to authority. Is there anything in the records or the analysis that you've done that suggests that the Crown was worried that these soldiers could potentially be a threat to them if they chose to do it? I.e., was there any sort of prediction of the revolt in 1381?
I don't think so. Helen, what do you think?
In the 1378 Parliament, in the opening speech to Parliament, there is this kind of warning that there are lots of rumours being spread in the country, and that if these rumours are allowed to go unchecked, that this might cause further insurgency amongst the population. They don't specify soldiers, but they talk about people who are rumour mongers, they use that phrase, who are circulating these kinds of comments about government, about John of Gaunt, probably, you know, about the war itself as well and how that's not going well. And there's this sort of vague prediction that if we let this go unchecked, we might be in for further insurgency, you know, further calamity.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
Richard apparently says something like, peasants you are and peasants you will remain, or something like that. You know, again, how true that is up for conjecture, but it's sort of a message of retribution.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
One of the things that you talk about in your research is the fact that these soldiers not only get involved in physical revolts, but they are destroying records. They're destroying manorial and governmental records. So could somebody tell me about what's happening there and why they're doing that?
Well, that's not just soldiers, that's the rebels. So that's what the rebels are doing. I think Helen can add to this, but the view is that you destroy the records because the records are, say, something you don't want to be exist anymore. So it could be that you owed a debt, for instance, so you want to get rid of that bit of paper that says you owed a debt to someone, or it was some sort of record of landowning and you wanted to destroy that because you felt the landowning was yours. Helen, what do you think on that?
Yeah, I think that it's really interesting in looking at their attitudes to the written word. You know, these are people who would either be illiterate in modern terms or, you know, certainly have a different relationship anyway to documents. They see them as symbolic. They see, as Adrian said, that their name might be written in a tax list somewhere, but they're suspicious of it because they don't know, you know, or in a legal account, and they don't know what's being said about them, but they know that their name is there. And so what we know in the revolt, they make bonfires of these kinds of records as a symbolic defiance to government who want to have their name in writing. They destroy, for instance, the records of the Exchequer, which they identify because they have a green wax seal. So they go around trying to find these documents, anything with a green wax seal, and burn them. They also burn all of the or large parts of the records of the University of Cambridge and, again, make bonfires of them. So it's this kind of suspicion of the written record. But at the same time, it's really interesting that they also want, they see the utility in it because they want, as one of the demands they make to the king, they want him to grant them letters of pardon and manumission, which will be written up by the clerks in front of them right now and handed over to them. So, you know, at the same time as they're going around burning some records, they see the utility in actually having other records in their pockets before they agree to return home.
Yeah, and we're also going to research, I mean, you might think it's bad that we've lost these records, but we'll actually research the absence of records because we'll be able to map where have they burnt these records, and does that tell us anything about the network or the way that the rebellion spread, actually by showing where the absence of records tells us something.
So we talked quite a lot about the soldiers and what you've done there. Has your research brought up any, and one would assume that most of the soldiers here, the people we're talking about, would be men. Has your research brought up any insights into the role of women in 1381 at all?
Yeah, it has. So this is something that I was particularly interested in, because in the official records, you know, the records written up by the chroniclers in particular, who are men and for the most part clerics, there isn't much mention of women. And there's this sort of lacuna in the historical account. But interestingly, when I did my PhD research, I was looking at pardons. And in the pardon records that relate to the revolt, there are names of women, not huge numbers, but there are women in those records. So I was thinking, well, why do women want to seek a pardon? For presumably something that they've done in the revolt, but they're not mentioned in the official accounts. And the research that we've been doing has shown up a few interesting accounts of women's involvement. So just to give you a couple, there's one woman called Marjorie Tawney, and we know about her because she wrote, or she had written by a scribe, two petitions to the king, which survive in the National Archives today. And we've uncovered these petitions. And in them, basically, she's wanting to petition the king for something unrelated to the revolt itself, in that she's concerned that for a number of years she hasn't been paid what's due to her after the death of her husband. She's a widow, and she's claiming this money that is owed to her. But how she links to the revolt is that she claims in these petitions that at the height of the rebellion on the 14th of June in London, when the king and his officials are in the Tower of London, she claims that a message, a proclamation, is given out throughout the streets of London to say that anyone who has an issue, who wants to come forward, can come to the Tower of London themselves physically and present their petition to the king, and he will hear them and, you know, he will listen to their demands. So she sees this as her moment. So she grabs her son, and together they make their way through the streets of London, which presumably by this time are burning, you know, that there are riots and destruction going on all around her. And despite all of this, she sort of elbows her way, you can imagine her, to the front of the crowd at the Tower of London, and tries to present this written petition to the king. And what's interesting about her account that survives is that, you know, she's saying that this proclamation went out to people to arrive at the Tower of London, which actually contradicts with the official accounts we get from the chroniclers, who say that the king and his officials were desperately trying to disperse the rebels from the tower and get them to meet the king in a more kind of organized way at Mile End, in the east of London. So the official account is that they're trying to disperse them, but Marjorie is insistent that she was actually called, you know, with her son to make her way to the tower and present her petition. And the end of her, I mean, it doesn't go well for her son, who's kind of caught up in the fighting and arrested and actually dies in prison. But Marjorie seems to have made some headway with her petition and being granted this money that she's claiming. So hers is an interesting story. And the other woman that I would highlight is a woman not from London and from the home counties, but from Derbyshire. So this is a woman called Gauditha Statham. And she lives in Morley, in a small village in Derbyshire. And really, it's her five sons that take part in the rebellion. But she clearly has a role to play in organising what they're doing. And her name comes up because, as I said, of these pardon records. She's there getting a pardon, as well as her five sons, for their alleged involvement in the revolt. And what it seems they do is that they take arms and fight against local landowners in their local village in Derbyshire. They're sort of a well-to-do gentry family. And again, this contradicts the idea of them all being peasants. So they're big players in the local area. And they feel that they have rights to land owning in their locality that are being kind of thwarted, if you like, by the big absentee landowner of the area, which is none other than John of Gaunt, the king's uncle, who is hated. And so they seize this moment. Again, it sort of shows us that the news of the revolt in London is spreading far and wide in the country. So it's reached Derbyshire that they've heard about the revolt happening in London. And Marjorie's sons go and sort of occupy the lands that John of Gaunt owns. And they do things like, again, burn local records and kill a local official and so on. And this is seen to be an anti-Lancastrian revolt in particular, that it's John of Gaunt that they're particularly targeting. So again, it shows that there's another angle to the main events in London, that further abroad in the country, there is this feeling of animosity towards John of Gaunt. And then Gooditha herself clearly shelters her sons from kind of any retribution or from being arrested by royal officials. They're hidden by Gooditha, and she's trying to keep them safe out of harm's way in the aftermath of the revolt. And then, as I say, her name and those of her sons crops up in the pardon records. And then another interesting link to what Adrian's previously been saying is that four of her five sons have significant military service, so we can track their military records in the French wars. So it all ties together quite nicely in the story of Gooditha and her sons.
That's fascinating. And you talk there about pardons and royal retribution, which leads us in nicely to a question about how would you characterise the end of the revolt? Is it put down by the crown? Is that a fair way of describing it?
Yeah, it is. So the main events that I described in London end when the rebels are persuaded to move back out of the capital. There's a scene in the Chronicles, which might or might not be true, which has the young Richard II on horseback sort of saying, "Follow me, I'm your leader now," because Wat Tyler's been killed, and leading them out of Smithfield and then away from the capital. That might be kind of mythologizing Richard's role in the events, but however it happens that they do leave London and go back to their localities. I mean, this is also a time of summer, you know, soon there'll be harvest and so on. So these people who are agricultural labourers for the most part need to get back to their day jobs. So they disperse from the capital. As I said, some of them do have, they have been able to gain these letters of manumission and pardon that the crown in their kind of anxiety had scribes write and give and disperse amongst the crowds of rebels. But in the aftermath, in the weeks and months afterwards, the crown completely backtracks on that and says all of those grants that we gave are null and void. Richard apparently says something like, "Peasants you are and peasants you will remain," or something like that. You know, again, how true that is up for conjecture, but it's sort of a message of retribution. And then what they do is they send in kind of They're legal commissions, but they have a very kind of military appearance, sometimes led by nobles who are soldiers and probably with, you know, bodyguards and this kind of thing. And they send them into the localities, into the home counties and into East Anglia. And they start hearing trials against the accused rebels. Some of the ringleaders are executed in obviously kind of exemplary fashion, you know, that they're taken out and executed. Some of them also are pardoned. And again, this is interesting for, I think, how the crown sees, in a pragmatic sense, the limits of its capability in punishing these people, that it thinks if we give exemplary pardons to some of the ringleaders, then we can sort of show that we're reconciling and we're getting on top of this. And then what they do by the parliament, which sits in October and November of 1381, they debate in parliament well, actually, they interestingly debate some of the reasons why this rebellion happened. And it's not all kind of condemnatory. Actually, some of the people who speak in parliament say that the rebels had a fair point, and that actually those in government, those officials, those nobles have kind of lost their purpose and haven't fulfilled their function in society by leading and by protecting those below them. On the social ladder. And so they say, therefore, we're to blame, you know, in taking some of the culpability for this rebellion in Parliament. And so this debate plays out. And then in Parliament in November, what they do is decide to grant a general pardon to everyone who's accused of participating in the rebellion. And this pardon is going to be granted for all actions that happened during the summer of 1381. And that people initially can come and give their name in this pardon roll, which is why it survives for us to use today. And then later on in subsequent years, the pardons opened up to more and more people. They do, in the initial pardon, they give a few high-profile exceptions. You can't get this pardon if you were involved in, specifically in the execution of Simon Sudbury and, you know, other clauses. But gradually those clauses are taken away in the subsequent years. And the pardon list contains over 3,000 names of those people who decided to take the crown up and actually receive a pardon.
Can you just remind us who Simon Sudbury was? Because I don't think we mentioned him.
He's the Archbishop of Canterbury. And his, interestingly, his head, his preserved head, survives in a church in Suffolk. So you can see this kind of image. I think we put it in the magazine article, did we?
Yeah, absolutely. So he was executed by the rebels, summarily.
Yeah, taken out, beheaded on the tower.
He was a chancellor, and they also executed the treasurer. Who was the prior of the Hospitallers as well. So they were very, as I say, extremely high profile, very close to the king, these two men who were executed.
Is there anything in the evidence that you've looked at that suggests that the soldiers who were involved and those and the sailors and those with military experience who were involved in the rebellion were treated more harshly after the revolt than those who were your standard peasants?
We don't think so because, I mean, there's not a lot of time. What we do is obviously trace their military service. Did they continue to serve? Unfortunately, as we mentioned, there's not that much opportunity to serve. Now, there is a interesting, my colleague Andrew Prescott has noted that one of the big reactions to the revolt is in Norfolk, led by Bishop Despenser. You might think, what a bishop. He was a very warlike bishop, Henry Despenser, and he had a battle with the rebels, the Battle of North Walsham. And if people like a laugh, they can see Alan Partridge reenacting that on YouTube, the Battle of North Walsham. And it's quite hilarious. He takes off his puffer jacket and turns into the bishop and beheads a few people on the battleground. But following this, he's actually told off. He actually has to get a pardon. That's right, isn't it, Helen? He has to actually be pardoned for his what he does. Because he's acted he's acted without the judicial authority. He's just gone ahead and punished rebels himself. But this is what Andrew's discovered, is that in 1383, the Bishop Despenser leads a campaign to Flanders. He leads it under the auspices of a crusade. Now, at this time, there's numerous popes. It might sound, we've only just had two popes ourselves. One pope resigned and we received a pope. At this time, in the Middle Ages, there's two popes. It's probably too much for this podcast, but in a sense, the English support one pope, the French and people in Flanders support another pope, and he goes on a crusade to Flanders. Why does he do that? He does it to raise money for his campaign because he can sell indulgences. So rather than charge a tax and raise another poll tax and all that trouble, he can actually raise money by indulgences. But we find, and get a long way of getting around to it, but we find men serving in his crusade are the same men who were rebels and the same men, I guess, he would have tried to punish. So there's this idea in we find this all the time. We're looking at soldiers and also other continuity through this period is that people are survivors. You know, they survive and they go on to serve with the person who was probably trying to put them down following the rebellion.
Excellent. And you're absolutely right. We'd be too tricky to go into that Pope story right now. We are looking at sorting out a papal history podcast, listeners. So we'll sort that out sooner or later and then we'll cover that. So look, wrapping up, what now do we know about the Peasants' Revolt of 1381? What further insight have you provided about the aims and ambitions of these rebels?
So I think the thing that we're proving for the most part is that when we call the people of 1381, that there is a diversity of people who are not in the official accounts of the revolt that hopefully we'll be able to tell more about in terms of their stories and their reasons for joining the revolt. You know, the soldiers that we've mentioned today clearly have the kinds of reasons for joining, that they're trained in military service, but they're discontented in some sense with the direction that war is going, and the sense of lack of leadership from government. There's the traditional story of the poll tax and the fact that people were discontented with the demands that the government were increasingly making for direct tax levies on populations. And you can add to that these stories that we're revealing about the corruption of local tax officials. So it was known from the chronicle accounts that some of these tax officials were sort of pocketing, on the side, taking money. They were also accused of really horrendous sort of sexual abuse cases, really, where they are saying that they're going to prove the age of women by these kinds of interfering with them sexually and so on. So there's all this kind of corruption going on in the level of government officials. And I think there's a sort of sincerity we're seeing to the ideological commitment that they're showing. You know, when we think about John Bull's preaching and this radical egalitarian statement calling for essentially the equality of people and the abolition of serfdom, you can see that people, some of whom clearly were not serfs themselves, you know, that they were well-to-do gentry, they might, and we've also been finding that they might have been clerics. So churchmen are playing a key role in this as well. And not churchmen at the elite level, bishops and so on, but local parish priests. I think they're showing a sincere commitment to this idea that the abolition of serfdom should be carried through, that this is an unfair and unjust system of indenture, and that they want to see an end to that, even though they themselves don't suffer from it. And the other thing we're seeing is that this is a nationwide rebellion. So people in Derbyshire, people in, we haven't mentioned, but in Yorkshire, in Scarborough and Beverley, they join in a rebellion. They have local issues, and they're clearly not issues that are necessarily tied to what's going on in London, but they're hearing about the revolt and they're coming out in support of it. And when you think about the quite high stakes that they're facing when they actually come out in armed rebellion, you know, you can really see how committed they are to this cause, I think.
Now, people get quite exercised about the concept of rewriting history. I guess in a way, some of the things you talk about here would be, particularly in terms of the nomenclature. I'm thinking about, say, the Victorian naming of the Peasants' Revolt that you talked about to start with. Should we be giving this a different name? Should it be the Soldiers' Coup or something else? What do you think?
I think that would be probably... Not even worse, but as bad. You know, the number of soldiers in it are probably, you know, I'm going to guess now, but probably, you know, 10-20% of that group. They're obviously key, as we've mentioned. But I think it's a number of, you know, as Helen says, it's not one big thing. It's a number of things brought together. And when we dissect the big thing we can do is the people of 1381, we're looking at the people and who they are. And our other team members, I should mention them, Herbert and also another Helen, are helping us bring this data together from the very local level. You can find out who these people are and what did they want to gain from it. And sometimes it's extremely personal. It's they've got a problem with someone specifically, as Helen mentioned, with the Stathams. And it's that they use the rebellion, they see what's going on around them, and they follow up with some personal thing that's happened to them, and it's, I think that's for the first time we're able to identify that, just because, going back to the start, because of the big data approach, it allows you, it's strange, isn't it, we're using big data but actually revealing stuff on the personal level.
Brilliant. What about you, Helen? Are you comfortable calling it the Peasants' Revolt, or do you want to rename it?
If I had to go for a name, I quite like what they use at the time, which is sort of something like the Great Rumour, because this idea of rumour emphasises the spread of words, the whispers, the communications that were going on amongst the rebels. So the Great Rumour I'd go for.
Nice. Sounds like a title for a book right there. There probably is one. Okay, wrapping up, where next for this research? Is this at all a citizen history project? Are you looking for people to get involved and interrogate your data set?
We're going to make the database open by, as I said, by the end of this year. We want people to look. They can start writing up if they can find out interesting individuals or places or incidents we're looking for them to write. We've got a set of stories up there already, but we're going to add other people adding them to us. We've done that before in our other projects. If they want to help by other ways, yes, get in touch. We're trying to gain interest during May and June. We're going to tweet the revolt, so starting daily, and as we go through the process and into the actual days of the revolt, there'll be every half an hour. Hopefully people don't think it's actually real, like Orson Welles and War of the Worlds, or else we might get an actual real revolt going on, but that's going to happen. And we're also taking part in the Estuary Festival with a open outdoor exhibition with panels outside. And that's in the Essex, in the Wat Tyler Country Park at the end of May, beginning of June. So hopefully people can go out and do something and visit that and read those panels we're developing there as well.
That was Professor Adrian Bell and Dr. Helen Lacey of the People of 1381 Project. Their project website is 1381.online. You can also read their feature in the May issue of BBC History Magazine. And we have more Peasants' Revolt content on historyextra.com. If you want to check out the Estuary Festival that Adrian mentioned, the details for that are in the show notes of this episode. Also, Dave mentioned another podcast in our back catalogue, the interview with Remy Amble about prisoners of war in the Hundred Years' War. You can find that at historyextra.com. Just search for Hundred Years' War. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman and Brittany Colley. Join us tomorrow for an episode on 1951's Festival of Britain.